Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click Listen Live, and enjoy the show.
Hello, this is Dr. Emmett Miller. Welcome back to Conversations with Extraordinary People. Here, our goal is to look beyond the superficial, to encounter the essence of the human experience, to explore new and creative ways of meeting life's obstacles, challenges, and opportunities successfully, and to discover new and powerful ways of healing, balancing, and optimizing the function of mind, body, emotion, spirit, and behavior. At this time in history, we desperately need to heal and transform at both the individual and at the collective level. In each episode, we bring you intelligent conversations with the movers and shapers who've created the new medicine and other holistic approaches to individual and collective healing. Along with this, you will receive practical tools and experiential guided imagery meditations to help integrate the wisdom our guest brings us. So once again, it's time to relax, focus your mind, and open your heart to the power within. Welcome to another paradigm-shattering conversation. Because today's guest, Bob Stahl, is a well-known teacher of mindfulness, and especially mindfulness-based stress reduction techniques, I thought I'd say a few words about mindfulness to lead off. It seems like we're hearing about mindfulness everywhere these days. Newspapers, magazines, self-help shows, Dr. Oz, Dr. Drew, and there are even regular elective classes on mindfulness in medical schools as well as universities. It's being taught to patients in most major hospitals in the country. And now, after 40 years since we first introduced it, just this year, it made the front page of Time magazine, where it was trumpeted to be the way, quotes, to find peace in a stressed-out, digitally dependent culture. Because that just may be a matter of thinking differently. The word mindfulness and the concept were virtually unknown in our culture, in our country. And the notion of meditating or practicing the techniques of mindfulness was not known when I began my medical practice at all. In fact, almost no one had heard the word mindfulness except for people that had studied Buddhism or one of the other Eastern disciplines. Indeed, the whole Eastern mode of thought, which focuses on the whole rather than an exhaustive search for differences and opposites of specific parts. The Western paradigm believing that everything could be broken down to its component parts, and then if you understand how each part works, then you understand the whole system. But the whole is more than the sum of its parts. And if you want to positively impact the functioning of the whole, it's important to address the highest levels of system. If you wanted to improve the health in a grade school, you wouldn't go to the kindergarten children. You probably wouldn't even go to the kindergarten teachers. You'd be much more likely to be effective if you went to the PTA or if you went to the principal of the school. In other words, it's important to address the highest levels of system, and that way change can take place throughout the rest of the system. And for the human being, the highest level of system is the conscious mind and its spiritual or philosophical beliefs. Mindfulness is a most important tool for being able to reach and guide the conscious mind and help the conscious mind access and express its spiritual or philosophical values. including health, happiness, and success. I first introduced mindfulness approaches in my practice by helping patients to learn how to think about the world in a mindful way, a way that would give them an opportunity to focus their attention on the important issues in their lives while dispelling distractions, conflicts, frustrations, and other emotional reactions that were interfering with their physical health, their emotional well-being, or their ability to think about things effectively. As a general practitioner, a family doctor, my goal was to heal the whole patient and the whole family. And it rapidly became clear to me that the vast majority of the ills people were experiencing were the direct result of the way they were dealing with the stress in their lives. And again, this was now back in the early 1970s, before anybody even knew what the word stress meant. And so it was an amazing discovery for me, really exciting. And I'll share that with you at another time, some of the excitement that I had in discovering a whole new form of therapy that, in, for my patients, the mental images by which their lives were being run and their ability or their inability to regulate their emotions, that was what was producing the physical diseases that people were having, not to mention their addictions and bad habits and emotional miseries. Now, for most of us, most people, our emotions are out of balance. And those out of balance emotions affect our lives in ways we wish they didn't. This is what we call emotional dysregulation, and it can lead to excesses of anxiety. It can lead to depression or anger, resentment, rage, greed, jealousy, envy. All of those things, none of them feel good, but they come along. And if they're strong enough, they can actually lead to what we diagnose as a clinical mood disorder, such as major depressive disorder or general anxiety disorder, social anxiety disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, habit disorder, addictive disorder, etc., etc., etc. Now, my job as a healer is to treat the whole patient, whether that imbalance or illness or diseases in the physical body, or if it's in the emotional regulation, in their pattern of thinking, or in their relationship with other people. So as I figured this out, of course, I wrote my first book, which is in 1972. I published Selective Awareness, An Introduction to the New Field of Mind-Body Medicine. Selective awareness was my term for mindfulness, and it refers to the ability that we have, that if we choose to do so, we can focus our mind wisely, and we can become selectively aware of certain important things and selectively unaware of other things that would be distracting. And through being mindful and using that selective awareness, people could make amazing changes in their health. Less than 3 years later, Herbert Benson, a Harvard professor, demonstrated in controlled studies that the relaxation response could be induced through mindful meditation, and it could have a profound effect on many illnesses, from hypertension to heart disease and so forth. A few years later, Carl Simonton published Getting Well Again, showing how cancer patients could alter the outcome of their illness, reduce their suffering, and so forth. Meanwhile, in the basement of Massachusetts General Hospital, John Kabat-Zinn was demonstrating that people who had, quote, failed therapy in various departments of the hospital could nevertheless reduce their disability, in some cases heal their illness, through that approach that he calls mindfulness-based stress reduction. All of these early experiments that we did have been verified by thousands upon thousands of scientific experiments. And today, then, we're going to explore some of the ideas about awareness and mindfulness that have been found to be really effective. And we're going to especially focus on some of the learnings and discoveries that we don't generally have until we reach what is popularly called the second half of life.
For me as a young physician back in the 60s, I wandered into a workshop at Davis, and there was a fellow sitting up on the stage, the full auditorium packed to the rafters, and the fellow sitting there, he was a Caucasian, but he was dressed as if he were from India, sitting in a meditative position with his eyes closed, answering questions from the audience. Someone asked him a question, said, "What would you do if you were out walking in the desert and you were bitten by a poisonous snake and you knew for sure that no one could possibly help you? What would you do?" And he said, I would go into meditation and I would thank the snake for leading me out of this lifetime and into my next. And I thought that was about the weirdest thing I'd ever heard in my life. However, it fascinated me. At the time, I had been practicing with hypnosis and hypnotherapy in my medical practice. I was right on the verge of inventing the first relaxation tapes then, and toward the end of the 60s. And not too long after that, I read a book by this fellow, and the book was entitled Remember, Be Here Now, written by Ram Dass. That really began to awaken me to a very important principle that has been central in my practice of medicine and psychology, and as well in my own personal life, which I guess is best summed up by that fundamental Buddhist principle that the source of all suffering is wanting things to be different from how they are at this moment in time. You know, I've seen that when I was using it in a medical practice when I was working with hypnosis. And by inducing a hypnotic state, that is, by just talking to a person and having them think a certain way about the situation that they were in, they could become so relaxed that it was possible for us to do surgery, even to remove a gallbladder, without having to use any other medications or anesthetic agents. Because as long as the person didn't compare how they were feeling in the moment to how they were feeling 10 or 20 minutes ago before we opened their abdomen, then, strangely enough, they could avoid feeling any pain or discomfort. But other than such dramatic uses of this concept, there's much more common, mundane uses and uses that we can all make of this kind of awareness. And here to explore this a little bit further with us today is Bob Stahl. Bob founded and directs mindfulness-based stress reduction programs in 3 medical centers in the San Francisco Bay Area. He's a longtime mindfulness practitioner, and I hope he will share some of that with us. And he lived in a Buddhist monastery for 8.5 years. He is a certified teacher of mindfulness-based stress technique, and he trained at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. He also serves as an adjunct senior teacher for OASIS, the Institute for Mindfulness-Based Professional Education and Innovation, of the Center for Mindfulness in Medicine, Healthcare, and Society at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He's also a co-author of Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Workbook and also Living with your heart wide open. And I hope we'll be able to get to some of that too. I met Bob, I don't know how many years ago, when we ended up collaborating on an internet project. So, Bob, welcome to Healing Times.
Thank you, Emmett. It's an honor. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'd like to begin. For you, because a certain number of the people who will be listening to our show may never have tried any of these tools or techniques before, may not know anything about meditation. So, what kind of opened you up in the beginning?
What opened me up to meditation?
Yes.
I have a little trouble hearing you.
Yeah, to that pathway that you're on now.
Yeah.
What would you say opened you up?
Well, actually, it's very funny to say it's involved a little bit of a life story, but I'll try to make it short. This is a very real experience. It happened to me when I was 4 years old. I was riding the back seat of my parents' car, and I had this realization as we were driving to my grandmother's house, and I have no idea why this realization arose, but it was the realization that I and anyone could die at any moment.
Mm.
And I remember mentioning this to my mother and father, and they said to me very lovingly, "Don't worry, Bobby, it's not going to happen for a long, long time." And I knew by the sound of their voice, even at the age of four, that they were being kind to me, but what was being told to me was not the truth. Because I knew that one could die at any time. And unfortunately to say, this was at the age of four that I realized this, that by the time I was nine, I had lost three significant people in my life. My brother died of an illness that I shared a room with. My best friend who lived across the street died one night going into a diabetic coma. And lastly, my grandfather who lived downstairs to me, who I was very close with, died of a heart attack. And this led me in early age into a state of a lot of grief and despair and confusion. And then growing up outside of Boston in the late 50s, early 60s, the times were changing and people grew their hair long and drugs and the Beatles, and our school went on strike and high school went on strike and closed during the Vietnam War and didn't reopen for a whole year. There was a lot of unrest, and with all of these different things happening, as well as my own internal experiences, I was very confused and very lost. And I ended up getting into downhill skiing and got admitted into a small state college in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. And was still very lost and taking regular classes, and nothing was really that meaningful to me, and I ended up flunking out in my second year and being readmitted back on warning. And I decided at that point that maybe I should actually look in the course catalog and see if there's anything interesting. And there was this class that was advertised about Eastern wisdom, and I really didn't have much experience with anything with the East other than growing up in Boston and eating at Chinese restaurants. However, I loved Chinese food. I loved the artwork. And I remembered as well that even the Chinese waiters and waitresses had a different vibe than like the regular American restaurants. So I said, I'll take this class. And I walked in on the first day, and I'll never forget, my professor, who was a Caucasian, was sitting on top of his desk in a full lotus position. I had never had a professor like this ever before in my life. Most of them were pretty uptight in suit jacket and ties and formal attire. And there he was sitting on his desk. His name was Bill Jackson, and began talking, and as time went on, I realized that this guy really feels like he knows something that I don't know. He was embodying something that I had never experienced in another human being before, and I realized that whatever he knew, I wanted to know what it was that he knew. And the first book that he assigned to us was The Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu, and I began reading this book of wisdom, the book of way of life, the Tao Te Ching, and I couldn't believe that someone had thought about life in this way. So much resonated within me, yet I had never spoken with anyone about any of these types of wisdoms of life. Didn't know that this world existed, and I finally came to one particular poem that Lao Tzu wrote, epigram number 47. It says, "There's no need to look outside your window, for everything you need to know is inside you." And I realized, after reading that, that I had been so lost, and that if I needed, and that if I wanted to know anything about myself, I needed to begin to look within. And that really began my deep journey of meditation. And it was interesting to hear you talk about Ram Dass, because not, you know, fairly soon after this, I went into a small bookstore in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, and what stuck out to me was this book called Be Here Now by Ram Dass, and I picked it up and was like, wow. And so I've been on this practice and journey since the early, you know, mid-70s, early 70s, and feel very grateful for it.
Mm-hmm. Great. And what did you do next after that? How did you begin to integrate that into your life?
Well, I so discovering the world of Eastern wisdom, I ended up taking many classes in philosophy and psychology, ended up graduating in getting my bachelor's degree in philosophy and religion. And that led me to wanting to go to graduate school and taking a journey across the United States looking at graduate schools that had an emphasis in integration of mind, body, heart. And I ended up finding the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco, a small graduate school that founded by Haridas Chaudhary, who was a scholar from India that was bringing together Eastern and Western wisdom and psychology into a graduate program for master's degrees in counseling psychology and various degrees and doctorate degrees. And so I ended up going to the California Institute of Integral Studies and getting a master's in counseling psychology. And while I was there, I started taking studying with a Buddhist scholar and teacher. Her name was Dr. Rina Sirkar, who is also a Vipassana mindfulness meditation teacher, and took my first retreat with her, formal mindfulness retreat. And I really, after taking this 8-day experience, I realized that mindfulness was really a path that I want to dive deeply into. It felt like I was really coming home, and this was my practice. It was the beginning of a potentially a lifelong journey, which has remained very true. And began sitting a number of Vipassana retreats with her, and in time she invited me, amongst some of her other students, to travel to Burma, now known as Myanmar, Southeast Asia, and meet her teacher, Thangpu Lucero, who's a very revered meditation master. And so I traveled to Burma with her amongst some other students, and actually had the opportunity to ordain with Thangpu Lucero in his forest monastery in central Burma, and was there for a short period of time, just a few months, and then disrobed. And we had invited Thangpu Lucero and a group of monks and nuns to come back to the United States, and so they came back, and I was with that group, and we came to the United States and established a place where they, like a temporary monastery, a place that we rented in San Mateo, a little bit south of San Francisco. And then as time went on, it became clear that we wanted to find a forest monastery. And with the help and support of the Western and Asian communities in the San Francisco Bay Area, we found a property in Boulder Creek in Santa Cruz County, and we bought a property and started a Buddhist monastery there. It's called Thangpu Lukabaya Monastery, and then I ended up living there for 8.5 years, caring for the monks, supporting the monastery, and doing a lot of intensive practice. So it's been kind of a long and windy road, and when I eventually left the monastery, I needed to find some work, and I was hired at the Cabrillo College Stroke Center, which is in Santa Cruz, working as a counselor, working with people living with stroke, Parkinson's, MS, other neurological and orthopedic conditions, and was part of my job was also teaching stress reduction, and I began teaching people there with mindfulness practice. And this was very helpful, and I would get a lot of feedback from people. I remember an old woman saying to me, yeah, this mindfulness stuff is keeping me out of the nursing home. And I go, what do you mean? And she was an older woman. She said, look at me. I'm an old lady. In the middle of the night, I got to go pee, and I have to walk to my toilet. And so when I get up, I'm mindful of myself getting up. I'm mindful of lifting my foot and moving it forward and placing it down. I'm mindful of walking so that I don't fall down and break my hip and end up in a nursing home. And I would hear other just very practical, down-to-earth stories of just how mindfulness was being very helpful in dealing with the stroke, what was coming up physically, mentally, and emotionally, and so forth. And I was telling an ex-monk friend of mine about my experiences at the stroke center, and he said, well, a book was just published about this, working with mindfulness and illness. It was called Full Catastrophe Living by Jon Kabat-Zinn. And he sent me a copy, and I read it, and I go, my gosh, I can't believe this guy created this whole program. And I wrote John a letter thanking him for the book. This was right after it was published.
Mm-hmm.
And then he called me a couple of weeks later and said, thank you for sending me that letter. And I wrote this book for people like you, and if you're ever in the Massachusetts area, come and visit me at UMass. And it turns out that I was actually going there a few months later to visit my family, and I met with John and Saki Santorelli, who is now the executive director at UMass Medical Center, and saw what they were doing and decided, this is what I want to do. And they didn't even have professional trainings at the time, and essentially they said, well, just go for it. So I came back and started my first mindfulness-based stress reduction program at the Cabrillo College Stroke Center in 1991. And it's now 2011, 20 years later, and I've been doing this for many years.
Wow.
That's a long-winded story. I wasn't expecting to say all that, but you asked me.
That's a great story. Yeah, I too was very impacted by the Tao Te Ching. Mm. The passage that that touched me the most, I think, maybe it was number 11, about that the 30 spokes has the wheel, but it's really the hole at the center that makes it useful,
mm-hmm.
and that the ball is made of clay, but it's really the space inside that gives it the opportunity to act as a vessel,
mm-hmm.
or that a house may have walls of stone, but it's really the doors and windows that are necessary before it can act as a room.
Mm-hmm.
So that although value comes from what's present, usefulness comes from what's missing, and to me the Tao Te Ching had a great deal to do with the celebration of the emptiness,
mm-hmm.
And to me that related to emptying the mind and coming into the kind of emptiness of the moment, or that emptiness at the end of the out breath and before the in breath comes in. There's an opening there that one can pass through to come into the present moment, and that gives us such an incredible ability to make changes of the kinds that we really want to make in our lives.
Absolutely.
And so talk a little bit about mindfulness for people who don't know what that is. How would you summarize what is mindfulness?
Sure, I'll be happy to speak about that. And I just want to, though, just resonate back with you. Yes, we have a love for the Tao Te Ching, and I still go back to the Tao quite often, and have its beloved in my heart, the teachings of the Tao Te Ching.
Mm-hmm.
And, for all practical purposes, mindfulness, as Ram Dass coined in his book, the name Be Here Now, mindfulness is really concerned about being present to our lives. And, when we look at it, the only moment that we ever really live in is right now, this present moment. The past is gone. The future has not yet come. Yet so much of the time we are thinking ahead or remembering the past. Actually, a former student of mine, a psychologist, once said, as she began her mindfulness practice, she had a deep insight. And she said, I'm realizing that all that my mind does is rehearse and rehash. And I loved how she just coined it like that, the rehearsing and rehashing of the mind. And we wouldn't know that we are rehearsing or rehashing unless we're mindful enough to become aware of the workings of our mind. So this practice of mindfulness is helping us to recognize our own mind, our own thoughts, emotions. But simply put, we can say mindfulness is a practice of being present. When we eat, let's be aware that we're eating. When we're talking, let's be aware that we're talking. When we're brushing our teeth or folding the laundry, all these different activities of day-to-day living, we can bring our mindful awareness to them. So it's this quality of being present. And perhaps a deeper question is, what does being present have to do with working with stress reduction? So we can explore that as well in a little bit. But this quality of mindfulness is about learning to be more present. And it seems that young children naturally have that ability, but they aren't always aware that they are present. But when a baby is unhappy, they cry. And when they're happy, they laugh. And when they have to poop, they poop. And when they want to fart, they fart. And they're just fully themselves. They may not necessarily have full awareness that this is what's going on here, but there's a certain quality of freshness and presentness to the moment. And we, as grown-ups, have that ability to be present, yet at times we're hardly ever there because we're thinking about other things. Or maybe that's why John Lennon, the Beatle, once said, life is what happens while we're busy making other plans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, excellent. And mindfulness-based stress reduction. Say a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, I think that the mindfulness-based stress reduction was founded by Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, who originally was a molecular biologist. He actually was introduced to mindfulness while he was going to MIT, getting his PhD in molecular biology. And he heard, from what I understand, Philip Kaplow, who wrote The Three Pillars of Zen. He gave a talk at MIT, and after John heard that talk, John became very interested in mindfulness and began practicing both in the Zen tradition and in the Theravada and Vipassana tradition. And after he graduated from school, he got hired as a faculty instructor at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center and was teaching in the medical school. And the story goes that he went to a Vipassana meditation retreat at the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts in his early years at UMass, and was on a week-long or couple-week retreat. And while he was there, he reflected on his love of sitting, of mindfulness meditation practice, and also his love of medicine and science. And supposedly, while he was there, this whole inspiration and came up of why not try to bring these two worlds together. And it was at the retreat that he kind of conceived this whole notion of a mindfulness-based stress reduction program. Let's bring these two worlds together. And he went back to UMass and put together a pilot project, and it was approved, and he began teaching. He developed an 8-week course called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, and began to offer this to people living with stress, pain, and illness. At first, he contacted a lot of physicians at the center and asked them that the medical center said, please send me people who you don't know what to do with. So he got a lot of chronic pain patients, a lot of people with anxiety and so forth, people living with illness. And because he had a science background as well as teaching these classes, he also began to do research and study and published quite a number of studies. Working with people with stress, pain, and illness. So those are the early years of mindfulness-based stress reduction. And in 1993, Bill Moyers got, somehow he'd heard about Jon Kabat-Zinn's work, and he was putting together a 5-part series called Healing in the Mind. And Jon's program was, Bill Moyers had asked him whether they could feature his program in this 5-part series, which he said that would be fine. And in 1993, Bill Moyers, that 5-part series, Healing the Mind, did come out, and that really brought national and then later international attention. So many people began to call wanting to develop programs like this in their own medical centers. In the United States alone, at this point, there's I believe UMass says now there's about 640 mindfulness based stress reduction programs in the United States alone, as well as they are found on every continent of the world. It's really become very exponential. And of course, mindfulness has found its way not only from in medicine, that where Jon Kabat-Zinn developed, but it's now components used in various in psychology. There's mindfulness based cognitive therapy, there's dialectical behavioral therapy, there's a lot of pieces where mindfulness is being used in different psychological treatments, as well as in neuroscience and education. There's many different areas that mindfulness is being studied and applied to. Coming back to a full circle, what does mindfulness have to do with stress reduction?
Yeah.
And I'll just say very briefly that, you know, mindfulness is the faculty of awareness that helps us to become aware of what's actually happening in the present moment. And there's a very beautiful quote by Viktor Frankl that speaks to this possibility of choice and freedom. And it says that between the stimulus and the response, there is a space. And in that space lies our freedom.
Uh-huh.
And mindfulness really offers us the ability to choose perhaps a more constructive way of dealing with the stresses at hand rather than a non-constructive or perhaps even a destructive way. When we think of mindfulness, we can learn to respond with awareness to the stresses at hand rather than, if we're in unawareness, we are reacting to stresses in a way that could be counterproductive to our health and well-being. And I know that you've had a lot of interest in, you know, one of the founders and pioneers of mind-body medicine. And when we look at mind-body medicine, you know, neuroscientists are trying to understand and, of course, have begun to chart out the various neural pathways between our thoughts and emotions and our physiology. And the evidence is overwhelming of this intimate connection. And so I think the premise that I would like to propose that if indeed our thoughts and emotions do affect our bodies, and the evidence is overwhelming that they do, then being mindful of the thoughts that we think, the emotions that we feel, and its impact on our body could be very, very important. And so if we can become mindful of our own reactivity and begin to respond to it in more successful ways, this could be very helpful.
Uh-huh. I'll bet that we have a lot to say about what happens in that space between the stimulus and the response.
Yeah.
That we do a lot of interpreting, although we're often not aware of it. We're so accustomed to rehearsing and rehashing.
Yeah.
It's constantly going on in our mind. So, what is it they say that when the pickpocket meets the saint, all he sees is his pockets? Because those, the rehashing and rehearsing create a filter, and that filter allows us to see only some of what's actually going on in the world, and at the same time adds a lot of distortions and bells and whistles and twists to the experience of the world, except that we don't know it. And such a huge amount of our pain, so much of our anxiety and depression, and, you know, as the Buddha says, the source of all suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Not training ourselves in how to see what's there.
Yeah.
And of course we see what that does in terms of healing, and mind body medicine is of course now grown to be a gigantic field, and I would say Jon Kabat-Zinn has certainly been probably the major force in really getting it to the place where it's undeniable, and where it's now you know, practitioners of medicine all over are awakening to how much of the healing potential we haven't harnessed within people. And I think the disaster that the so-called healthcare system is in, it's not a healthcare system at all, is because we simply have not integrated these ideas into our practice of medicine. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, those of us who practice this, certainly rather than the usual kind of medicine where there's a kind of an energy field, like a wall between the practitioner and the patient or the client, and that person is seen as being injured or sick, and where we imagine ourselves as to be pretty perfect and healthy, and there's a distinct lack of empathy and compassion in a huge number of areas where mainstream medicine is being practiced. But people who practice in the way that you and I do, and the way mindfulness-based practitioners work, is quite different, because we're part of the mix. It's not the old separation, but we really are part of a whole that is in the process of healing. Can mm-hmm. you speak to that a little bit from your experience?
Well, my sense of maybe being part of... Actually, you were mentioning earlier about seeing through filters, like a pickpocket, you know, pickpocketer sees through, you know, looks at a safe and just sees the pockets. And so these are filters, or sometimes in psychology we'll use the word, this is the narrative, the self-narrative, and that's our story. And I think part of, you know, the collectiveness of those that are beginning to become more mindful is recognizing that these stories are self-limited, and that they are not full definitions of who it is that we are. And when I think of the Buddha, and often it's attributed to him that he attained the unconditioned, or he was known as the unconditioned one, and when I think about it from a more psychological standpoint, and I think actually the heart of the Buddha's teachings is much more psychologically based than it is faith-based. He says, when we speak about, at least in the Theravada Buddhist tradition, the one that is enlightened in Pali is called an arahant, and an arahant means, as it's translated into English, the destroyer of the enemies. And what enemies? It's greed, hatred, and ignorance, which are psychological factors. And when we speak of the Buddha as the unconditioned one, he is, I really refer to it more as that he has broke through the sense of the conditioned narrative-based self. All of these filters and stories and self-limiting definitions. He saw through and began to understand the causes of this, of his suffering, the grasping, the aversion, as you alluded to earlier. And I think, you know, those that are on the path, I don't know if I'm answering your question.
No, it's fine.
You're asking me, but this is the tangent I'm on. That, you know, I think that those of us on the practice are beginning to recognize the limitations of our, not to negate our stories. Our stories are important, but they are not the full picture. And to begin to see that we see through a filter, and that there's reasons that we see through this filter. And if we're told in some ways as we're growing up that we begin to have a self-definition that we're unworthy, we're inadequate, we feel shame, or we're not a good person, we begin to act out in ways that manifest that. We've developed this story, and part of our practice of healing and awakening is to break free from these conditioned stories that we've told ourselves, that we've convinced ourselves, that we somehow believe others see ourselves in the ways that we see ourselves, and we can begin to become more free. We need to begin to understand these workings of our mind that at times can enslave us.
Uh-huh.
I don't know, was that you were asking me? I'm not.
Yeah, it's okay. What has it taken you to in terms of your own discovery of yourself at this point in your life?
Well, I mean, I can say that I definitely am not fully realized, and I definitely have a lot of amnesia. But I'm so thankful to have this practice that helps me to recognize at times when, wow, I'm really caught in a place of reactivity, and I'm acting out of an old, deep wound from my past that is not yet fully understood. And so I'm so grateful that I have a practice that helps me to begin to recognize when I'm fully invested in my Bob Showness, if you will, in my own reactivity. And of course, once I become aware that I've been trapped by my reactivity, I've been trapped by my feelings of shame or trapped by my feelings of unworthiness or not being seen, once I become aware of this, I can begin to step outside of it. I can begin to, like, it's when I'm not aware of it, I'm just cycling through my own reactivity. So I'm tremendously grateful that, you know, that there's a practice that helps us to awaken, maybe just for a moment, but even in that moment, it begins to free ourselves up. We begin to not take ourselves so seriously.
Mm-hmm. And as you shared with us, some of your earliest experiences had to do with an interest in death and that fact that we don't live forever. And now you're down at the toward the other end of the spectrum in your own life. What's on your mind now?
Well, I think because of my earlier experiences with death, I look back on it. I think it's forced me, driven me within to really want to confront death and to open to death. And so, I guess in the Theravadan Buddhist lineage, this is a perfect place to practice, because when the Buddha he teaches what's called four foundations of mindfulness, and the first foundation is of the body, the second is of feeling tones of experience, the third is mind states, and the fourth is called the dharmas, or the essential teachings within the Buddha to be realized. But within the section of the body practices of meditation, there's actually practices on parts of the body, which has been very fascinating. There's actually a practice called the 32 parts of the body meditation, consisting of 20 solid parts and 12 liquid parts. There's meditations on what the body is comprised of, and from ancient Eastern philosophy, they break it down into solidity, liquidity, motion, temperature, or the four primary elements. But and then there's practices on meditation on the decomposition of a corpse, beginning on the first day of death until the body turns into dust. And this was just great stuff for me in my early years of practice to confront and to be with death, and spent a lot of time going to the cemeteries, meditating in cemeteries, and I've been to quite a number. I actually teach what's called the 32 Parts of the Body Meditation class, and I actually take my class to our local community college once a year. It's actually an 8-month class on body parts, and we actually go to anatomy lab, and I have a friend of mine that's an anatomy professor at the college, and we go in after hours, and she gives us a tour of the lab, and we get our gloves on, and we're able to really examine the different body parts. So I'm very much into the body and its life and its death, and I feel like the only way that I can experience deeper reconciliations by immersing myself in these contemplative practices on death and on life, on both. And, I know some people aspire to die asleep. I aspire to die with my fully awake.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll maybe just say I have a very powerful personal story to share of my teacher, Mindit Seto, Burmese Buddhist monk who died at the age of 98. And the last time I saw him alive before he died was when I went and visited him in Burma maybe about 10 years ago. And it's my last night there. I was leaving the next day, and I asked Seto, what did he plan to do when death came knocking on his door? At the time, he was about in his early 90s, and and I said, I know death can come at any moment, but what do you plan to do? And he looked at me for a really long time, and then he smiled, and then he said to me, Bob, are you afraid to die? And I was saying, he caught me off guard. I wasn't expecting that. I was asking him about what he was going to do, and he could see I got kind of disgruntled, and he kind of smiled and said to me, you need to meditate more. And so then I said, that's right, Seto, I do. And then I said to him again, Seto, tell me, what is it that you plan to do when death comes knocking at your door? And he stared again at me for a very long time, and then he smiled, and he said something that I'll never forget. And he said, if I see something, I'll be mindful of seeing. If I hear something, I'll be mindful of hearing. If I smell or taste something, I'll be mindful of those. If I feel sensations in my body, I'll be mindful of sensations. If there's thoughts that arise in my mind, I will be mindful of these mind states. This is how I will die, and this is how I want you to die.
Ha. Huh. Wonderful.
To be fully awake, to be fully present. And so, every year I'm one of the resident teachers at Vipassana Santa Cruz, which is a Buddhist meditation center, and once a year we go to the cemetery and we do these death practices with the students. And so it's a very much part of our practice to dwell on morbidity, but to dwell on this, to fully recognize that death does indeed come, that I think opens us up to the preciousness and the fragileness of life. And when we look at the story of the Buddha, what got him on the road to awakening was when he was 29 years old, he realized for the first time in his life, and in a very deep and profound way, maybe he had somehow known this before, but somehow at 29, he really got that he could not escape from aging, illness, and death. And it was these feelings that catapulted him into a sense of urgency. That's what, there's a Pali word, it's called samweka. And what samweka means is when you realize that death can come at any moment, it catapults you into a sense of spiritual urgency to wake up and to penetrate deeply, what is this life?
Yes, yes. And I'll bet that has something to do with your book, Living With Your Heart Wide Open.
Yeah, that's more about the narratives.
Uh-huh.
And how, that these self-limiting narratives can inform and influence our sense of shame, inadequacy, and unworthiness. There'll be at some point I'm going to be working on a book on the parts of the body and death meditation that will go more into those areas. But I really, in my experience working as a mindfulness-based stress reduction teacher and also teaching, Buddhist meditation, I think that there is a worldwide epidemic that often is unnamed, and that is the lack of self-compassion, the sense of unworthiness, shame, inadequacy, feeling flawed. There's so many different descriptors that so many people live with. People come to stress reduction programs for many different reasons, but underneath a lot of them is a sense of not feeling like you're enough.
Yes.
And so Living With Your Heart Wide Open is really trying to address how, these feelings of feeling inadequate or unworthy or feeling flawed, they didn't come out of nowhere. They came out of our past experiences, and we need to understand more about the development of how we've developed this story. Mm-hmm. And of course, once we can begin to understand how this, that we actually have a story,
yes,
we're already beginning to get ourselves out of the story.
Yeah, wonderful.
And also being able to develop a greater sense of self-compassion for ourselves in our flawedness.
Oh, great. Well, we're reaching the end of our time here, so before we neglect it, would you share with people how they can learn more about your work, website-wise? Or?
Yeah, I have a website, mindfulnessprograms.com.
Mm-hmm.
That's one website. There's another website, mbsrworkbook.com.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one other website, yourheartwideopen.com. But any of these books are available in your local independent bookstores and major bookstores and mm-hmm. Amazon as well.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing with us today, Bob. I hope we'll be talking again.
Thank you, and I'm sorry, I felt like I talked more than you, but you were, I guess, interviewing me, but I very much appreciated talking with you too, Emmett.
That's great talking with you. Thank you so much.
All right, many blessings. Take good care.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
And now as a special lanyap for you today to give you an idea of how I have used the technique of mindfulness, which I have always called selective awareness, in my work. Here's an excerpt from the World Peace Meditation from the CD called Healing Our Planet. You can learn more about that at drmiller.com. and as you allow your inner awareness to follow the sound of my voice and the sound of the ocean, the sound of the music, you notice that even that point that your eyes are focused on gets smaller and smaller until it fades away even from your internal focus. Everything dissolves into a blur. And you may give your eyelids permission to close. And as they do, simply allow your eyes to gently roll upward behind your closed eyelids and to focus on a point there on the back of your forehead, as if you could see the word relax or something that symbolizes relaxation to you right there on the back of your forehead. And give yourself permission to come into this moment, into the here and now, as if you are allowing yourself to believe that here is the only place there is, and now is the only time that is here. And to intentionally choose to accept as true that right now, this is the only moment that really exists. That the past does not exist, and that not even a single second of the past can ever happen again. That the past is just a story in a book in your mind. That you have the ability at this moment in time to put that book on a shelf in the back of your mind and choose to write your own story with wisdom and to choose wisely. Choose to focus on the truth. The future is not somewhere you are going. The future is being created by you right here in this moment. And you can give yourself permission now to focus all of your awareness on this moment and let thoughts of the past or the future fade into a blur and disappear completely. Good. Now become aware of where you are right now on the surface of our planet. Think about all the water and all the land that makes up planet Earth. And sense the connection that you feel to this world and the caring that you have for the planet. The purity of its waters, the clarity of its air, its precious minerals. Make room in your thoughts, in your heart, for all these. And bring to mind the vast variety of Earth's green growing things, the trees that supply our oxygen and building materials, the plants that provide food and medication, even the invisible plants that break down complex molecules to produce compost, and make room in your thoughts and your heart to care for these fellow living beings, the plants, the givers of energy. Now sense the wonderful variety of animals, from the smallest one-celled creatures that form the base of the food chain, all the way up through the fish, the reptiles, through the feathered flying creatures, to the warm-blooded mammals, the wild ones, the domesticated ones. And sense your caring and compassion and connection to all these animals, the receivers. And make room in your heart and in your thoughts for all of them. And now sense your connection to all the people on this planet, and to all your wise and loving teachers, to the prophets and the saints. Let there be room in your heart and your thoughts for all these.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People, on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life, visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the drmiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais.